Dad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Here at WICR, we love connecting with our listeners over the airwaves. And you can connect with us even more by liking us on Facebook and following us on Twitter at WICR Online, where you can find exclusive station content. Don't forget to also log on to our homepage on WICRonline.org.
Broadcasting from the University of Indianapolis, this is 88.7 The Diamond, WICR-FM and HD1 Indianapolis.
The opinions expressed on the following program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WICR management or ownership.
It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
And good afternoon. I am Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we use art to teach science. Welcome to
She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And today we are going to be talking with our artist-scientist team about media literacy in the age of fake news. So there's plenty to talk about today, and we certainly want your calls and comments too. That number is 317-788-3314. And then a bit later in the show, we are going to be joined once again by Jim Vway with the University of Indianapolis Art and Design Department here to tell us more about some of the new art that they have right here on campus and what's new in the Crystal DeHaan Gallery, too. But, Mark, introduce our guests who have joined us this afternoon,
yeah,
please.
It's great. One of our guests is Indie Star journalist Sarah Bowman. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, happy to be here.
Great. Welcome, welcome.
And we have back again physicist Andy Gavron. And so we're going to be talking about collaboration in a teacher workshop that they're going to both be in, as well as you, Jill.
Mm-hmm.
And we have designed it around the idea that there is a misunderstanding about media, and particularly about science and communication and how that gets communicated to the public. And so we want your questions as well. And please call us at 317-788-3314. So how does one go about thinking about putting together a teacher workshop that's on media literacy?
Well,
let's just start right at
this.
The top, Andy.
Sure. We talked about this a long time.
Yeah.
And Sarah and I and you and several others have been talking about how you do that. And it's not easy, but there's so much stuff to talk about. I think the most difficult part is actually deciding how to keep it short.
Right. That is, that as we've kind of been getting the program together and everything. But Sarah, because also it's like something you just do every day.
Right. Well, and like Andy said, I mean, when we've gotten together to kind of talk out and try and plan these workshops, all of a sudden we realize some of the meetings we've had have gone as long, if not longer, than, you know, what the workshop is supposed to be. And it's like, how do we condense all of this? But it has been really interesting to try and break down and really actually think about the things, you know, the decisions that we make every day in our line of work, whether Andy, you know, in his research and the science that he does, or myself in putting together a story, and to actually kind of walk that back and think, okay, how do we do this? And then how do we kind of pull back that curtain a little bit for, you know, these teachers that we're trying to show them and talk to them about media literacy, and how do they pass that on to their students?
Because as we've said before many times on the show, with when it comes to any aspect of art and science, we have to start when people are very, very young. And
yes.
I think with the media literacy, it's critical. Because that, I think that's maybe quite possibly the most confused group of all right now.
It is. Absolutely. And I think, don't you both feel that some of what we've done in a more modern era, mm-hmm, has circumvented some of the safeguards that we had?
Oh, certainly. I mean, you know, in the past, when science was discussed in the media, it was a pretty slow process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had time to sit down and talk to somebody and describe the work. And we still do that as a starting point. But then there's Twitter involved, and mm-hmm. there are bots that forward things and write articles on their own, and there are websites that post things that look like summaries that have actually been written by a computer that's just taken a media release and sort of thrown out half the words and stuffed some of it together so that it fits in whatever its word limit is, and that gets passed on. There's so much automation out there that the human safeguards have been short-circuited.
And I mean, and even in situations where the humans do still are playing an active role in that process, the fact that we live in this 24/7 internet, you know, world means that we don't quite have that time to mm-hmm. sit down. And I mean, we have the time, but you're kind of not really in a situation where you can take it to really sit down and talk through with the scientists or parse through that, because it's, oh, well, we've got to get this up now before someone else does, or we've got to get up this up now so we can move on to the next thing, because it's a constant, you know, we need to keep feeding the beast, if you will. And so I do think it prevents us from really going as in depth into things or kind of really delving in and truly understanding what's there. Mm-hmm. Much more surface level sometimes.
Yeah, I don't watch, a lot of times I don't watch some of the news programs I used to watch on television. But the times I've had to tune in on, when I've visited my parents who watch them regularly, it's really interesting because a lot of it has become feeds mm-hmm. off the internet. Mm-hmm. And they have no idea what they're reporting on. In other words, they're just pulling it like I would. They found something interesting, they pull it, and they're not doing any reporting about it. They're just reading the feed.
Right. Well, I mean, because if you assume, and obviously you want to believe this is the case, and often it might be, but like Andy said, if a bot picks something up, but then all of a sudden you can see, you know, as reported in this place or according to this place, and you assume, well, if it's coming from them, they did their checking, so I maybe don't need to do as close of a check. And mm-hmm. yeah, like Andy was saying, that all of a sudden it just kind of keeps getting passed on, and it's almost a game of telephone then. And then sometimes you have to be like, wait, how did we get from where we started to here? You know, because it's not quite the same.
Right. What was once a 30-page scholarly article winds up as a 50-word item.
Right.
That then somebody has to summarize on the spur of the moment. And there are increasing pressures on the science side, too. You know, universities didn't used to have press offices that were mm-hmm. constantly emailing faculty and saying, you know, have you got anything? Have you got anything for us? We need something. Let us know when your next paper comes out. Let us know if you have a grant proposal that's accepted. We want to write something up. That didn't used to happen.
And part of that is kind of what you were talking about, Sarah, too. It's just to get the name out there, to mm-hmm. get your name out there. We're doing something. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what we're doing, but we're doing something, because it's that 24/7 cycle.
Right.
Gone are the days when in a newscast you had 2.5 minutes to tell a story. You're lucky if you have 30 seconds
right.
most of the time, be it television or radio.
Right. And yeah, same for us in print. You know, mm-hmm. print and online. I mean, where you used to have many more inches or words, you know, to be able to explain something, now it kind of keeps getting sliced shorter and shorter, and you know, it's kind of how do you give everyone what they need, but at the same time meet those demands, and it can be pretty tricky.
Then you also have the flip side of some of those websites that are credible that do allow more time for more in-depth stories. How do you hold someone's attention that long
mm-hmm.
when all of a sudden everybody, especially like we're saying, like the younger generations, which is why we're, you know, we're going to work with teachers on this, that, you know, the kids that are in elementary and middle school, I mean, that's all they know is short yeah. and sweet what comes up on their phone.
What fits on a phone screen.
Exactly, right. Or mm-hmm. what fits into, you know, the characters of a tweet
yes.
or, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And I think that's one of the tricky things, you know, headlines, for example, can be so tricky because, you know, how do you condense what might be a 500-word story? Or a, you know, 45-second story clip into, you know, a 10-word headline or a 5-second, you know, kind of summary of something, and try and do it in a way that grabs people's attention, and then get them to stick with you. Because, yeah, people are just looking at that headline, and that's their tweet, if you will, and they think they've gathered everything. And Andy, I know you've mentioned before, it can be tricky with science, you know, publishing and articles and kind of that same pressure to do that sort of thing. So how you get people to stick with you is something we're still trying to figure out. I think having a lot more visuals and graphics, or, you know, those sorts of things, at least for print, to really try and engage people. But it's something we're continuing to figure out.
You know, as I study this more from the science education viewpoint, one of my concerns I get is that we think that younger people can multitask. And yet after study has proven that that's not true.
Right.
I mean, they may do it, but they're not really multitasking, not really paying attention. So that fast feed, we think that they are more capable of doing that than somebody older, but study after study shows it doesn't.
No, it's really not. And in fact, as an educator, that's something that I try to convince my students of all the time. They say, well, you know, we can multitask. Your generation can't. I'm sorry. My generation was told the same thing as compared to my parents. Oh, we can multitask. We can watch TV and talk on the phone and read at the same time. No. No human being can truly multitask. It's not the way your brain is organized. And people are just much more efficient if they stop trying to multitask. So convincing students not to do that while they're studying for an exam or trying to get their homework done is a constant battle.
Yeah. That's Andy Gavran. He and Sarah Bowman are our guests this afternoon. We're talking about media literacy in the age of fake news. And if you have a comment or a question, please get on the phone and give us a call right now, 317-788-3314. Especially when it comes to science. I think this is a something that we really need to find a way to help people learn what is really true and what is really not out there, Andy.
That's absolutely right. Science, for good or ill, right now, there's sort of this sense in society that, you know, science is very important and that more people should understand science. But what does that mean? What does it mean to truly understand something?
Let's start with becoming
a scientist and being a reasonable consumer of science.
And as a scientist, as a researcher, if you have something that you want to get out, what is it that you want to get out? Is it the message of what you found? Is it the message of what you're doing? Or is it the message of what you're hoping to still learn about whatever it is that you're doing your research?
Well, I think it's all of those things. I mean, when we do a project, getting the message out that, you know, we found something, we answered a question, that's important. But there usually are additional questions that come up. You want to go deeper. You want to see that next level. When you find that something is happening, then it naturally leads to questions of, well, are there other things that could cause that same thing? Or does that affect some third thing that's going on? So when you explore nature is a wonderful and complex thing, and there's always more there to study.
So maybe that's something we as consumers need to keep in mind, too, that there really is never an exact answer when it comes to science.
That's right. You know, scientists there's an informal way that we speak amongst ourselves, that there's more formal ways. There are people who are philosophers of science who are even more formal than that. And then when we talk to the media or when we talk to the public, that's a different way of communicating still. And it is important to keep some of those distinctions clear. We do code switch in the sciences, depending on our audience. So there are certain words like proof. You know, scientists, when they're being careful, they never say, oh, I proved this or I proved that. What you do is you find additional evidence that supports this or that, or you find evidence that tends not to support this theory or that theory. But it's never just a resounding one experiment and this proves that or this disproves that. It's a multi-layered, long-term process.
I think what's interesting in that, Andy and Sarah, is the idea that you do have different audiences mm-hmm. in which you're going to speak. And in the advent of today, and I know we've talked about this in preparing the workshop, but the idea that some of that can be circumvented.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there is a process of knowing which audience you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
However, a good example is if you give a presentation at a conference as a scientist, it can be quickly picked up without
yes.
you publishing anything mm-hmm. and become something that you could watch and
right.
the public can watch, and you never intended that to be your audience.
That's right. In fact, I remember, I think I told you this story once, and I'll repeat it for the audience. One of my colleagues, when I was in graduate school, gave a presentation. He had discovered a particularly distant, you know, at the time it was the most distant object observed in the universe. And in the process of giving the talk, he referred to the Hubble constant. And at the time, that constant was not very well known. And everyone understood that there were multiple variations, multiple different measurements that weren't in agreement. But we understood that disagreement wasn't controversy. It was just something that needed to be worked out over time. But some media people were there during his presentation, and they picked up on the fact that there were two different measurements of this thing, and they really wanted to make it a controversy.
Mm.
And they were asking him all kinds of questions, trying to get him to say something bad about the people that used the other number. And happily, he had the wherewithal not to take that bait, but they were hoping that it would be something controversial, something that they could say was a problem.
Right. And sometimes that can be a big red flag right there
right.
when
yes.
you are reading something online or seeing it on the television or hearing it on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
That language, that red flag thing.
Right. Well, and, mm-hmm. and I think there also, in terms of kind of red flags and things like that, that I know we've spoken about is, you know, when you're reading something about a study or something like that, you know, if they kind of say, go to these extremes of, you know, this is the absolute best or the absolute worst, or, you know, kind of just painting these sorts of pictures, that should also be a bit of a red flag because, mm-hmm. you know, like Andy was saying, rarely is, you know, science is not exact, you know, and it's evolving. So to be able to kind of make those sorts of claims usually aren't the case, and often, you know, some media outlets do it more or less than others, but, you know, sometimes do try and take it to those extremes or try and have it be a bit more controversial, you know, or have a conflict that doesn't quite exist there.
Right, or more miraculous. I think
right,
we've all seen
right.
this, particularly having to do with reporting around nutrition or medical science, where it's like, oh, this is so healthy, and then you find out 2 years later, oh, this is going to kill you, and then it's healthy again.
Right.
We've all experienced that kind of reporting, and I think it's very rare that the scientists behind those studies were ever saying, oh, this is the healthiest thing ever, or this is going to kill you. They're saying, well, you know, this is better for people than we previously thought. Or
right.
it turns out that this has some nutritional value that we weren't aware of previously.
Yeah, and I think that hints at this idea that two things. One, science is linear.
Mm-hmm.
It's a regular linear process, which we know
right.
it's not.
Which it is definitely not.
And, you know, we teach in schools the scientific method, and this is what everybody does. But, in fact, it's a very highly creative,
mm-hmm.
artistic endeavor, really. And the other one that we get people confused with is that it has absolute answers,
right.
which is what you were alluding to, Sarah. It doesn't. It has approximations closer and closer
mm-hmm.
to what would be a right answer, but it could always be up for something that would be another argument.
Yes, I think that's true, although I think that argument, too, sometimes gets overblown. Science, I think you said it really well when you said that it's a process of successive approximations, getting closer and closer to, let's call it truth with a small t,
right.
not the big T. So people, as they work, they're refining ideas. We don't very frequently completely overturn anything. If a theory is well established, if an understanding of some process or some part of nature has been working well for a long period of time, we generally don't find, oh, that's completely wrong. What we find is that maybe that's a special case of something that is a little closer to that truth with a medium-sized T.
Well, I mean, I always think about the, for example, I guess a classic one is, you know, like red wine or chocolate or, yes, you know, is it, how many glasses a day should you have that's really good for you or really bad for you? And I mean, it seems sometimes in the media that it keeps flopping back and forth. You know, one year it will be like, have, you know, 5 pieces of chocolate a day and, you know, it's great, mm-hmm, for you. It'll keep you living longer. And then the next year it's like, don't touch dark chocolate. It's got all these things. And I think that also is hard because it breeds some mistrust in our, you know, audience, whatever it may be, because they're like, well, you said this last year and now you're saying this. So whether it's in the media that's conveying that message or whether it's in science and like, well, clearly they don't know, you know, what they're talking about. They can't seem to figure it out. But I mean, it can be tricky in that translating, you know, what is a very kind of approximate successive process to something that wants to kind of be more definitive.
That's right. I think people are often looking for something definitive. And I'm sure reporters, and I don't want to speak for you too much, but you want to give people something that's clear.
Right.
You want to write something that people can say, okay, what was the take-home message from this? It was this. And scientists don't want to give you something that's so cut and dried. So sometimes you probably do feel like you need to massage things, get right, a little closer to a take-home message.
Well, and I mean, like you were saying, a lot of times after Jill asked this earlier, when, you know, when you're doing a study or putting out some research, obviously you have some, okay, you know, these were some of our findings, but a lot of times it almost raises more questions for you than, you know, it's kind of, well, now we want to explore this or see where this right goes. But in the media, a lot of times your job is you want to give answers. Yes. You don't want, yes, to kind of convey that uncertainty that leaves people after they've read or listened or whatever it may be saying, well, wait, I know less about this than when I started reading this. So it can be kind of tricky on how do you, and like you were saying, you know, you kind of code switch based on your audience. Uh-huh. I mean, it really is almost like a translation of, even though it's all English, mm-hmm, I mean, you know, in our audiences, but taking it from science language to something that is approachable, if you will, for the average person. And it's how do you, you know, walk that fine line and balance it between making it something that's digestible that they can understand, but at the same time not diluting it so much that you really do get so far away from the science, you know, and it's not kind of being respectful of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the big tensions in, mm-hmm, reporting on science is how do you walk that line between diluting it too much,
right,
and but also making it comprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
The other tension I think that we've danced around a little bit, and I just want to make it more explicit, is the tension between what scientists love, which is the questions,
mm-hmm,
and the discovery process,
right,
versus what I think sometimes we believe the public wants to hear, which is answers,
mm-hmm,
and definitive discoveries that are like, okay, now we can not worry about this anymore. I think scientists do love the discoveries. Those moments where something becomes clear is wonderful, but the goal isn't for it to be over.
Right.
You know, and I think that is a really great parallel between both of what you do as, mm-hmm, an investigative reporter,
mm-hmm,
and what you do as a scientist, in that, mm-hmm, you are more about the questions and discovering something than it is about giving a definitive answer, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times, and this is something, you know, I have these conversations with my editors often because, you know, we'll kind of I'll give them a draft of a story after having, you know, done an investigation into something. And yeah, at the end of it, you know, it's kind of, it's raising more questions than it's giving answers. It's giving some answers, but it's actually kind of being like, well, what does this mean? Or what about now? Where do we go from here? Those sorts of things. And that's kind of, yeah, like I said, a conversation I've had to have with my editor of, it's okay to actually kind of leave a story with questions, because rarely are things so, you know, black and white, cut and dry. You don't have that in real life. It doesn't exist in most cases. So, yeah, it's kind of, hey, this just is a situation now for continued reporting, more stories like you, more mm-hmm. research, you know, just kind of continuing to follow it and see where it takes you.
That's right. And if I can change the subject just slightly now, because we were talking about chocolate and red wine, and those are
cravings.
Topics that I love, but they do touch on another issue that has to do with media literacy, and that is confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
That was another piece we were hoping to weave into our piece with teachers, and that we're planning on doing that. And, you know, I mean, I love chocolate and I love red wine. If I read a story that says that these things are good for me,
Sign me up.
I'm going to latch on to that and say, well, yeah, that's, I always felt that way.
Right.
I'm just going to up my chocolate intake just that little bit more. Whereas if I see a story that says, oh, it turns out that chocolate isn't good for you at all,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to say, well, you know, I've heard that it is good for me quite a few times, so I'm just going to discount this one.
Right. Well, and in those situations where people potentially see that and do go to do their own research, say, well, hey, I thought it was good for me. I mean, that's good. We want to encourage people to you know, not just accept something, to go and see where that data is coming from, where that, you know, kind of start from. But in today, again, talking about the modern era, the internet can be great in those things because we have some of these resources at our fingertips. But then it's kind of so much it's overwhelming. And what is a trusted resource? And also, you know, the internet holds everything, and so something can pop up from 10 years ago that there's been much more science and research done since then, but it's like, oh, well, that's set. And, you know, either someone may see it's from 10 years ago and kind of disregard, or they just might not notice because it's like, oh, well, it was popped up first thing on my search, and that tells me what I want to hear. It confirms, you know, what I thought to be true.
It confirms my bias.
Exactly.
And I think that's kind of where the whole fake news thing kind of came up, too.
Yes.
Well, if it's not what I believe, then it's fake news.
Right.
But it's really not. So what are some credible resources as a scientist? What do you suggest people do?
Andy? So whenever I – and this happens to me all the time. I mean, I'm a physicist, so I know a great deal about a relatively narrow slice of the natural world. I don't know anything more about biology than – an average person. So if I read some new discovery about biology, I'm not an expert. I haven't got any inside scoop on that. So I have to decide whether or not I believe that, and I go through a process. One of the first things that I do is I look in the article that I'm reading to see who it says discovered this. You know, sometimes it'll say Dr. So-and-so from X University. Well, I will go and Google Dr. So-and-so from X University and try to find that person's website. And maybe she's got a copy of that paper on her website so I can look at the original version. It's going to be a little jargony. It may not be something that I'm going to read the whole thing of. But at least I can read the beginning, and scientific papers almost always start with an abstract, mm-hmm. a little summary at the beginning of what was discovered. So I'll read the abstract, and the first thing I'm checking is, does this really say what the media account said it did? And very often I find that, yeah, it's not contradictory, but it's much less extreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a watered-down version, but a more cautious version of the same conclusion. The other thing I'll say about that is that I'm very mistrustful of headlines. The article is often very good, but the headline is again, it's either more extreme or somehow tangent to the details of the reporting. Mm-hmm. Sarah, maybe can you give us some insight into how headlines are written?
Whew, gosh. That's a hard question.
And they're written to get you to read
exactly.
The article.
And yeah. I mean, and it also totally kind of depends on what news source you're looking at.
Right.
I mean, sometimes it's written by the reporter. Sometimes mm-hmm. there's, you know, kind of someone else in the newsroom, or sometimes even, you know, somewhere else beyond that, depending on the structure, that kind of just will read the first couple graphs or, you know, that sort of thing of the story and cobble something together. But kind of like Jill said, I mean, it's again a balance of how do you try and get a good summary of what the article is going to tell you, but at the same time catch your attention enough, you know, in relative to the 10 other headlines you might be seeing on right. your news page to get you to click and read that one.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, yeah, it might be a bit sensationalized. It uh-huh. might be a bit more extreme to try and be like, ooh, well, that sounds interesting. And then if you get into the article and read, you see like, well, hey, I thought I was going to read more about this, or that doesn't quite say what I thought it would.
So I think that's interesting because – in a way, you're moving up the level. So when I think about you, Sarah, and your job,
mm-hmm.
you're an investigative reporter,
mm-hmm.
and so you spend a little bit of time understanding the subject you're going to report on. You're not a complete generalist.
Right. No, I try and make myself an expert, yeah, as much
right.
as possible.
As much as you can, and you follow, for instance, you follow the environment and some other things.
Right.
But then when you get to headline writer, that's the most generalist you can have. They probably know nothing about any of the subjects they're writing headlines
right,
on because
right.
they just write headlines.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, in our newsroom at the Star, I mean, we do a very good job of the reporter has a, you know, really works in developing that headline to try and have it, you know, reflect the story, catch your attention, but
right.
not in a way that's disingenuous to what the story is. And I mean, we have folks in the newsroom who are experts on headline writing and those sorts of things. So it's always a conversation of working
yeah.
with them of, okay, what's going to, you know, what's going to, you know, captivate readers and what's going to reach them, but at the same time is honest and reflective of what I've reported and what the story says, and trying to figure that out.
Andy had a couple of suggestions from the science standpoint, as from a reporting standpoint. What are a couple of things that people of all ages, especially young listeners and parents and grandparents with youngsters, that they want to get them on the right track
right.
for learning about news in a way that's meaningful and purposeful?
Right, right. And where do they go to mm-hmm. see if it's a can be trusted? I mean, similar to what Andy said, I mean, I always try and obviously as a reporter, but as a reader also, trace kind of back where that information is coming from, see the source. So if they're citing a study or something like that, you know, who did the study and, you know, where is that coming from? Can I go find it myself? Also, I would always suggest trying to see if multiple sources are reporting kind of the same thing, because if you read something and it seems pretty shocking and, oh, wow, I didn't expect that, you know, do a Google search. See if other sources, other publications are kind of reporting the same thing, or is that one kind of an outlier? And then that might make you question, hey, maybe they didn't quite get this totally right. And I would also say check news sources that you might not normally check. You know, people obviously have their you know, go to, well, I'm going to check XYZ. But go to one that might not be the first one that you would think of, or might be, mm-hmm. you know, have a slightly different viewpoint than the source that you always go to see, you know, kind of is it coming from all different sides and angles. And those would kind of as to not do the more sciencey side, which I definitely think you should do what Andy suggested. But kind of if you wanted to keep it a bit more broad, those would be just quick ones that I would say are good checks.
I think good media is like good science is like good art. There's many options
mm-hmm.
and it's up to you to absorb them and come up with your own interpretation of them too.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Bowman and Andy Gavran, thank you both for joining us. And Any teachers or educators out there, you can go to the DaVinciPursuit.com website if you're interested in having these two come and talk a little bit more and give some tips that might help in your classrooms as well. And we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are going to be learning a little bit more about some of the art that's going on here at the University of Indianapolis. That's when She Says Art.
And He Says Science continues.
Igor Stravinsky had a brush with fame at the age of 11 when he saw his idol Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky, who had just weeks to live. And Stravinsky, 35 years later, remembered his illustrious predecessor with a project that Tchaikovsky would have loved. We'll sample it Monday. Join me, Michael Toulouse, for the Divertimento from The Fairy's Kiss.
Listen Monday morning from 6 to 10 only on 88.7 WICR.
Hello again, I'm Joe Girard, your host for Inside Great American Music. And as you know by now, we're here every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern right here on 88.7 The Diamond, WICR. Our show revolves around the great American songbook. And this week we feature Mr. Johnny Mathis, who has sold over 350 million records worldwide. Join us this Sunday, 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on 88.7 The Diamond, WICR.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR. Already a familiar face at New York City's famed Birdland Club and Jazz at Lincoln Center, vocalist Veronica Swift is known for her smooth jazz style and scatting. See her live with the Benny Green Trio March 8th at the Tarkington at the Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets at the Palladium box office at 317-843-3800 or thecenterpresents.org. Part of the Center's 2018-2019 season sponsored by Allied Solutions.
This is Rockin' Dave, inviting you to join me every Sunday at midnight for Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, an hour of the best rockabilly, jump blues, and western swing. That's Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, every Sunday at midnight on WICR The Diamond. Get your roots on!
Welcome back once again to She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And joining us now in studio are Jim V. Way, once again with the Art and Design Department here of University of Indianapolis. Thanks for coming back, Jim.
Sure, no problem.
You guys have a lot going on down here, a lot of really interesting departments, and you brought one of your faculty mm-hmm. with you.
Yes, so this is Randy Fry. She teaches animation and illustration for us.
Pretty popular class, I would think, Randy.
It has grown. We're really thrilled with that.
Yes, Randy came in to start the program, and she's made it explode already, so... We have a really nice thriving program, and she's expanding that more and more with both hand-on illustration and digital illustration.
Oh, I was going to ask that, Jim. So, to the listeners, there's the hand-drawn cell animation, the older form mm-hmm. that we think about, and then there's digital animation. But you're teaching both?
We're teaching, our focus is on visual storytelling. We're teaching traditional 2D animation. And along with the illustration. So,
wow.
Yeah. And everything changes so quickly in the world of technology.
Yeah, it does.
Holy cow, how do you keep up with all that?
A lot of extra classes keep up with all the technology. So,
except what doesn't change, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't change in terms of the basic good storytelling, right?
Right, exactly.
And drawing and illustration is illustration, whether mm-hmm. it's digital or not.
Yeah, it's all about visual storytelling and being able to communicate through your art and your images and tell the story that way. So, yeah.
And the reason we learned about Randy was one of her pieces of work was part of the faculty mm-hmm. exhibit that
right.
was at the Crystal DeHaan Gallery that you guys have over here, Jim.
Right, yes. It was in the faculty exhibition. And actually, that piece has now been moved to the library. It's on permanent display in the library. So anybody doing the permit collection walk around campus now can see that piece as well.
It's a beautiful piece, too, Randy. Tell us about it.
It's a 5-foot by 10-foot mural And it is kind of a nature theme. Tried to incorporate a lot of digital texture. And then along with the mural is animation that builds on that, kind of tells the story of nature developing and renewing itself.
So it's actually, it's like it's a video screen within the still picture itself. And when you first see it, you just see the still picture and you're drawn to it because it's just lovely. And then it starts to move and it's very interesting.
I enjoyed incorporating both of them and having the screen be surrounded by the image so that, you know, you're not just looking at a TV, which can be boring on the wall, but then you can see the animation and kind of see how it's developed from the still image into the...
Yeah, in fact, when we went around with Jim to see it, one of the comments I had was going down the road thinking of smaller LCD screens embedded into the artwork.
Yeah,
and
I'm really
I mean, you've got a large one embedded into it, but the idea that you could create something that is still and moving at the same time all over the place because our technology can do that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm fascinated with that. And, you know, as technology and screens develop, like you said, I see some more possibilities for that.
So yeah, me too.
Plenty of things to see down here on campus, both outside, inside, and in the gallery. You have a new show in there right now, Jim.
Right. We currently have a painting exhibition by Tom Cassie. He is an Indiana artist, and the work is a series of drawings and paintings he did while on, I wouldn't say vacation, but while touring Rome. And so he was there doing the work over about a three-week period. And so these are a lot of the pieces he did while he was there on site.
And it's a beautiful exhibit, and Randy, I can see you taking animation to it and making it even extra too. But it should be fun collaboration. And actually, Tom is going to be on the phone with us next week too.
Oh, awesome!
Which
That's
is going to be wonderful.
Right.
We're being told that we have to get to basketball here in the next 10 seconds. So we want to thank Andy, Sarah, Jim, and Randy for joining us today, and our listeners. And until then, I'm Jill Dittmeyer,
and I'm Mark Kiesling.
We're reminding you to stay
curious.
This broadcast of University of Indianapolis Athletics on 88.7 WICR is underwritten in part by Aqua Systems, online at aquasystems.com.